This is Portia K. Winters, and thank you so much for joining us today. I'm an audiobook narrator and a bibliophile, and today I'm going to be sharing with you a book that I have never read before and that I hope we can both enjoy together. If you enjoy edgy, dark, passionate books, sometimes a little bit of science fiction or urban fantasy, be sure to check out my website, PortiaKWinters.com. That's Portia, K-A-Y, Winters.com. But otherwise, let's get started on today's story. This is Carmilla by J. Sheridan, The Fanu. Carmilla, Prologue. Upon a paper attached to the narrative which follows, Dr. Hesselius has written a rather elaborate note, which he accompanies with a reference to his essay on the strange subject which the Miz illuminates. This mysterious subject he treats in that essay with his usual learning and acumen, and with remarkable directness and condensation. It will form but one volume of the series of that extraordinary man's collected papers. As I publish the case in this volume, simply to interest the laity, I shall forestall the intelligent lady who relates it in nothing, and after due consideration, I have determined therefore to abstain from presenting any precise of the learned doctor's reasoning, or extract from his statement on a subject which he describes as involving, not improbably, some of the profoundest arcana of our dual existence and its intermediates. I was anxious on discovering this paper to reopen the correspondence commenced by Dr. Hesselius so many years before with a person so clever and careful as his informant seems to have been. Much to my regret, however, I have found that she had died in the interval. She probably could have added little to the narrative, which she communicates in the following pages, with, so far as I can pronounce, such conscientious particularity. Chapter 1. An Early Fright. In Styria, we, though by no means magnificent people, inhabit a castle, or schloss. A small income in that part of the world goes a great way. 800 or 900 a year does wonders. Scantily enough, ours would have answered among wealthy people at home. My father is English, and I bear an English name, although I never saw England. But here, in this lonely and primitive place, where everything is so marvelously cheap, I really don't see how ever so much more money would at all have materially added to our comforts, or even luxuries. My father was in the Austrian service, and retired upon a pension, and his patrimony and purchased this feudal residence, and the small estate on which it stands, a bargain. Nothing can be more picturesque or solitary. It stands on a slight eminence in a forest. The road, very old and narrow, passes in front of its drawbridge, never raised in my time, and its moat stocked with perch, and sailed over by many swans, and floating on its surface white fleets of water lilies. Over all this the schloss shows its many-windowed front, its towers and its Gothic chapel. The forest opens in an irregular and very picturesque glade before its gate, and at the right a steep Gothic bridge carries the road over a stream that winds in deep shadow through the wood. I have said that this is a very lonely place. Judge whether I say truth. Looking from the hall door towards the road, the forest in which our castle stands extends 15 miles to the right, and 12 to the left. The nearest inhabited village is about 7 of your English miles to the left. The nearest inhabited slough of any historic associations is that of old General Spielsdorf, nearly 20 miles away to the right. I have said the nearest inhabited village, because there is only 3 miles westward. That is to say, in the direction of General Spieldorf's Schloss, a ruined village, with its quaint little church, now roofless, in the aisle of which are the mouldering tombs of the proud family of Karnstein, now extinct, who once owned the equally desolate chateau, which, in the thick of the forest, overlooks the silent ruins of the town. Respecting the cause of the desertion of this striking and melancholy spot, there is a legend which I shall relate to you another time. I must tell you now how very small is the party who constitute the inhabitants of our castle. I don't include servants or those dependents who occupy rooms in the buildings attached to the Schloss. Listen and wonder. My father, who is the kindest man on earth, but growing old, and I, at the date of my story, only 19. 8 years have passed since then. I and my father constituted the family at the Schloss. My mother, a Stryian lady, died in my infancy, but I had a good-natured governess, who had been with me from, I might almost say, my infancy. I could not remember the time when her fat, benign face was not a familiar picture in my memory. This was Madame Peridon, a native of Bern, whose care and good nature now in part supplied me the loss of my mother, whom I do not even remember. So early I lost her. She made a third at our little dinner party. There was a force, Mademoiselle de La Fontaine, a lady such as you term, I believe, a finishing governess. She spoke French and German, Madame Peridon French and broken English, to which my father and I added English, which, partly to prevent it becoming a lost language among us, and partly from patriotic motives, we spoke every day. The consequence was a babble at which strangers used to laugh, and which I shall make no attempt to reproduce in this narrative. And there were 2 or 3 young lady friends besides, pretty nearly of my own age, who were occasional visitors, for longer or shorter terms, and these visits I sometimes returned. These were our regular social resources, but of course there were chance visits from neighbors of only 5 or 6 leagues distance. My life was notwithstanding rather a solitary one, I can assure you. My governess had just so much control over me as you might conjecture such sage persons would have in the case of a rather spoiled girl, whose only parent allowed her pretty nearly her own way in everything. The first occurrence in my existence, which produced a terrible impression upon my mind, which in fact never has been effaced, was one of the very earliest incidents of my life which I can recollect. Some people will think it so trifling that it should not be recorded here. You will see, however, by and by, why I mention it. The nursery, as it was called, though I had it all to myself, was a large room in the upper story of the castle, with a steep oak roof. I can't have been more than 6 years old when one night I awoke and, looking around the room from my bed, failed to see the nursery maid. Neither was my nurse there, and I thought myself alone. I was not frightened, for I was one of those happy children who are studiously kept in ignorance of ghost stories, of fairy tales, and of all such lore as makes us cover up our heads when the door cracks suddenly, or the flicker of an expiring candle makes the shadow of a bedpost dance upon the wall, nearer to our faces. I was vexed and insulted at finding myself, as I conceived, neglected, and I began to whimper, preparatory to a hearty bout of roaring, when to my surprise I saw a solemn but very pretty face looking at me from the side of the bed. It was that of a young lady who was kneeling, with her hands under the coverlet. I looked at her with a kind of pleased wonder, and ceased whimpering. She caressed me with her hands, and laid down beside me on the bed, and drew me towards her smiling. I felt immediately delightfully soothed, and fell asleep again. I was wakened by a sensation, as if two needles ran into my breast, very deep at the same moment, and I cried loudly. The lady stared back with her eyes fixed on me, and then slipped down upon the floor, and as I thought, hid herself under the bed. I was now for the first time frightened, and I yelled with all of my might and main. Nurse, nursery maid, housekeeper, all came running in, and hearing my story, they made light of it, soothing me all they could meanwhile. But child as I was, I could perceive that their faces were pale with an unwonted look of anxiety, and I saw them look under the bed and about the room, and peep under tables and pluck open cupboards. And the housekeeper whispered to the nurse, "Lay your hand along the hollow in the bed. Someone did lie there. So sure as you did not, the place is still warm." I remember the nursery maid petting me, and all three examining my chest, where I told them I felt the puncture, and pronouncing that there was no visible sign that any such thing had happened to me. The housekeeper and the two other servants who were in charge of the nursery remained sitting up all night, and from that time a servant always sat up in the nursery until I was about 14. I was very nervous for a long time after this. A doctor was called in. He was pallid and elderly. How well I remember his long, saturnine face, slightly pitted with smallpox, and his big chestnut wig. For a good while, every second day he came and gave me medicine, which of course I hated. The morning after I saw this apparition, I was in a state of terror, and I could not bear to be left alone, daylight though it was, for a moment. I remember my father coming up and standing at the bedside, and talking cheerfully, and asking the nurse a number of questions, and laughing very heartily at one of the answers, and patting me on the shoulder, and kissing me, and telling me not to be frightened, that it was nothing but a dream, and could not hurt me. But I was not comforted, for I knew the visit of the strange woman was not a dream, and I was awfully frightened. I was a little consoled by the nursery maids assuring me that it was she who had come and looked at me, and lain down beside me in the bed, and that I must have been half dreaming not to have known her face. But this, though supported by the nurse, did not quite satisfy me. I remember in the course of that day, a venerable old man in a black cassock coming into the room with the nurse and housekeeper, and talking a little to them, and very kindly to me. His face was very sweet and gentle, and he told me they were going to pray, and joined my hands together, and desired me to say softly, while they were praying, "Lord, hear all good prayers for us for Jesus's sake." I think these were the very words, for I often repeated them to myself, and my nurse used for years to make me say them in my prayers. I remembered so well the thoughtful, sweet face of that white-haired old man in his black cassock, and as he stood in that rude, lofty brown room with the clumsy furniture of a fashioned 300 years old about him, and the scanty light entering its shadowy atmosphere. Through the small lattice, he kneeled and the three women with him, and he prayed aloud with an earnest quavering voice, for what appeared to me a long time. I forget all my life preceding that event, and for some time after, it is all obscure also, but the scenes I have just described stand out vivid as the isolated pictures of the phantasmagoria surrounded by darkness. Thanks so much for listening. The next portion of this story can be heard in the next podcast. So be sure to subscribe. And if you're looking for any of my Audible books, be sure to visit my website, PortiaKWinters.com. And never forget, you are worthy and loved. Goodbye, friends.